May it please the court, I'm Max Ray for Brenda Dietrich, the Social Security case. Back on March 18, 2016, I submitted a citation of supplemental authorities bringing to the court's attention Social Security ruling 16-3P. Now, 16-3P is a place where the agency provides a lot of clarification regarding some of its earlier procedures. They take out Social Security ruling 96-7P and replace it with clearer wording. But they pretty much structure how one is to approach the question of evaluating your claimant's symptoms and limitations. They say that you can look only at the objective medical record, only if that takes you to a fully favorable decision. If that doesn't take you to a fully favorable decision, then you're working on a symptom-based analysis where you go through the symptoms and limitations that the claimant described and then assess the evidence that supports them or takes away from them using the standard articulated in the regulations 404.15.23(c)(4). That really is consistent with the arguments that we had made in our initial briefing, even though this ruling clarification came out later in support of the analysis that we had presented. The most complex areas in this case are those at step 5. The ELJ stated that to determine the extent to which the limitations erode the light unskilled occupational base, she asked the vocational expert whether jobs existed. Well, the identification of jobs alone cannot enable one to know the extent of the erosion. There has to be a comparison. You have to know where you were, and then the vocational expert will help you find out where you end up.
And so doesn't the erosion analysis come into play only if the grids are used?
No. The Social Security ruling say that you use the grids as a framework. 8314 is pretty clear on this, and I've got a quote at page 47 of my brief. Use as a framework. You start with the grid rule that approximates the exertion level. And then you say, well, how much is that job base eroded? And then you look at the other grid rules for guidance on whether or not that degree of erosion still leaves the claimant with a sufficient opportunity where adjustment to other work would reasonably expect it. It's not just some jobs, it's a reasonable opportunity for adjusting to other substantial work. That's the key to it.
Is your argument that the grids always have to be considered regardless of whether or not the ALJ is relying on the grids to determine the residual functional capacity?
Yes.
So could you give me your case authority for the proposition that the grids must always be considered even if the ALJ is not relying on the grids for its determination?
I do not have case authority. I have the regulations and then I have the Social Security ruling that's outlined in my brief, Your Honor.
So you're saying the Social Security ruling 16.3 makes that requirement that the grids must be determined in each case?
No. 16-3P relates to the first set of contentions pertaining to the assessment of the claimant's symptoms and limitations. When you move to step 5, we're in the land, well, there's several 1980 era rulings. 83-14, again on page 47 of my brief, is most central, where it says that you look at a comparison between the occupational base that's left after erosion and get guidance from the grids.
Well, maybe I'm not making myself clear.
I'm sorry.
What I'm trying to find out from you is what regulation requires the ALJ to consider the grids even if the ALJ is not using the grids in his or her determination? What regulation requires that?
That quote for you on the top of my head. It's back in the section pertains to the, it's around 404.16, something I don't know exactly. Social Security rulings make it very clear that the grids must be used as a framework for decision. In all cases, a framework means that it gives you an idea of when you consider the residual functional capacity along with the other factors, age, education, work experience, you really bear upon what this person can bring and what opportunities they need in order to be successful in the workplace. The significant numbers determination is not just an abstract number. It has to be grounded in a framework in order to be meaningfully responsive to the effects of age, education, and other factors that bear upon employment success. The final area that I want to address are the questions regarding the vocational experts' knowledge and qualifications. Very commonly in these cases, and in this case as an example, you have a person called as a vocational witness who has primarily worked at managing a caseload of people who, for one reason or another, need to be placed. There's a vast difference between working in your community where you live, helping to place people who need jobs, and being able to assess national labor market statistics and give evidence as to the number of jobs in the national labor market.
Paulson, may I ask you if you're familiar with our precedent, Hill versus Astru? Are you familiar with that case? Hill versus Astru.
No, no.
That case seems to say that the ALJ may rely on the grids, and then Gray versus Commissioner seems to say that the ALJ alternatively may meet its burden at the fifth step by consulting a vocational expert. But do you take issue with those cases?
The case that I looked at was Thomas. And the question is, meet the burden of what? The expert is going to provide evidence. Thomas says that the ALJ's obligation to determine the claimant's occupational base may be by considered a vocational expert. It relates to the occupational base. Yes, the ALJ can go to the vocational expert to get information as to how many jobs there are, but that still leaves the determination of whether or not that number is sufficient to give this person opportunity. That's a separate decision of law to be made by the ALJ. And the grids provide the framework for that.
Counsel, Judge Gould, if I could interject a question. I thought there was an issue raised in your briefing about whether the ALJ had to call an independent medical expert.
Yes. Yes.
Could you elaborate on that? I haven't had too many cases with that issue, so perhaps you could elaborate to when that must be done.
The best case for the court to look at is Armstrong, and that's cited in my brief. Armstrong says, Armstrong isn't dependent upon whether there is no prior evidence in the file. Armstrong says that if it is not definite, if it is ambiguous, then the lay hearing officer, the lay judge, needs the help of a medical professional to decipher what it all means. And so the key is finding ambiguity or a lack of definiteness in the onset date. And that's what I get it. It's from the Armstrong case.
And what was the ambiguity in this case in the record?
Your Honor, the onset date for the SSI case was chosen based on application date because SSI can only be paid back to the application date. If it was clear the claimant was disabled at least that far back, then one needs to look at not only the evidence that showed the disability later, but implications showing how far back that had continued. We had testimony from a witness that as little as 3 months after the expiration of the date last insured, this person was functioning poorly. She was needing a lot of supervision. She was losing time.
Was that the fiancé? Was that the fiancé?
Yes, Your Honor. And then we go back further, and we have a statement in the correctional records that say that this person had instances that had been called blackouts before. You go back further, you have family history. It's a medical determination that requires considerable skill to sort out the bipolar, the personality disorder, the attention deficit, and put that in a meaningful package that translates into how bad off was she. It's hard for ladies to do that.
Counsel, are you familiar with that case, Sam versus Astro? Sam?
No, familiar.
It appears to say that no medical expert is required where the ALJ finds that the claimant has never been disabled.
In this case, the claimant was found disabled on the same set of applications. She's found disabled for purposes of the SSI claim. The issue is, does it go back beyond the application date? And the application date has nothing to do with any of the facts pertaining to how disabled she was. It's an administrative date. Unless the court has questions.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm David Burdett from Seattle, representing the Commissioner, the Acting Commissioner of Social Security, Ms. Berryhill. I want to correct two things that were misunderstood at oral argument, I think, by my worthy opposing counsel. And then I want to circle back to Judge Gould's concern about when a medical expert is needed to be called as a witness after we get to that. First of all, with regard to Social Security Ruling 16-3, that ruling is not applicable to this case. SSR 16-3 announced by its own terms that it was going to be effective from in cases heard from 2016 forward, I believe from the end of March 2016 forward. This case, as the court is aware, is several years old. I believe the ALJ heard the case in 2012. It is a change in the agency's policies. It clarifies that we will not going forward, the agency will not going forward to credibility evaluations in terms of judging a person's credibility, claimant's credibility. But going forward, in the cases that occur after the effective date of SSR 16-3B, that will be evaluated in terms of consistency or inconsistency with the evidence. That is not applicable to this case. This case was heard years before that ruling was issued. In the second place, with regard to whether or not RIDs are required to be consulted in every case, whether or not there's a BE, they are not. As Judge Hollins indicated, in the case of Bray, there was another case I was actually not familiar with, Hill versus S, but I have to confess, but Bray frequently cited, and also our case of Lockwood versus the Commissioner. Lockwood says, that's this court's case from 2010, 616F3rd 1068. Says at page 1071, the commissioner may meet the second sentence file burden, quote, in one of two ways. A, by testimony of the vocational expert, or B, by reference to medical vocational guidelines. The concern about the erosion of the occupational base is met when the vocational expert testifies. So that argument is without merit. Now, with regard to the concern that Judge Gould brought up about the allegation that a medical expert is required to testify. Counsel cited the Armstrong case. Requires a hearing ME, a medical expert, to testify at the hearing where the evidence suggests that the claimant may have been disabled prior to the date last insured. I put it that way because that's the requirement in Title II cases, and this is a Title II case. It was a Title II case that is Social Security disability insurance benefits. That is different from Title 16, under which the claimant was found to be disabled later as of 2009. This has been a Title II case, a disability insurance benefits case under Title II of the Social Security Act, all the way up. The reason is because Ms. Dietrich's disability under Title 16 which has a different set of requirements and conceptually serves a different policy purpose, was found at an earlier stage of the administrative proceedings before the case even got to the ALJ. The ALJ did not rule on Title 16. The ALJ did not rule on her disability from August 2009 forward. The ALJ was looking only to see whether she was disabled under Title 2 of the Social Security Act, which required her to prove that she was unable to work at jobs to see significant numbers in the national economy prior to her date last insured of June 2008. That is what the ALJ ruled on. That is what was appealed by Ms. Dietrich to the district court. That is what the district court said the ALJ properly did, and that is the appeal that Ms. Dietrich has taken to this court. There is no Title 16 matter before this court. Now, I believe you, Judge Rawlinson, cited the case of Sam versus Esther, and it says, at page 809, 550 of 3rd, 808, page 809, Social Security Ruling 8320 does not require a medical expert, meaning a medical expert to appear at the hearing, where the ALJ explicitly finds that the claimant has never been disabled. Here, the ALJ found, for purposes of Title II, that the claimant had never been disabled. He based that on medical evidence that suggested that.
What's your response to opposing counsel's argument that the determination of disability in the Title 16 realm carries over so as to preclude application of the SAM holding in this case?
Your Honor, it doesn't. It just doesn't. There's no authority for that. As we were discussing a minute ago, the two programs are different. People apply for them concurrently, as you know, but they are associated with different things.
What's your authority to say it doesn't carry over? You're saying it doesn't. Are there cases on either side of that?
Well, the question is, Your Honor, I don't have an authority that says that it doesn't, but the matter is that which of these two programs is an ALJ judging during the administrative process, if you see what I mean? There is a Title 16 determination in this case, which was not made by the ALJ. It was made regarding a later date. And so the ALJ wasn't put to the test of judging the Title 16 disability beginning in 2009. ALJ was only put to the test of determining what the evidence supported about a Title II claim, which necessitated the claimant proving that she was disabled before her date last insured. Not a concept that we use in the Title 16 context. Is that helpful?
Yes, thank you.
So in other words, your position is that the only disability determination that is an issue in this case is the Title II disability.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's it, exactly. Now, I'll be happy to answer other questions about the substantive matters, but we're happy to rely on our brief on that, but I wanted to address a procedural point. There was an issue in the briefing regarding whether the claimant, the claimant had two prior disability applications, both relating back to October of 2002, which was her alleged onset of disability. And there was an issue regarding whether those were de facto reopened by the ALJ going back and reviewing that period during the hearing. We had earlier in the litigation taken the position that they weren't, but I think probably they were under this court's rule. So I think that is a procedural matter that doesn't bear on the validity of the ALJ's determination about the disability. But I bring it up just to say that in case the court disagrees, then yes, the whole period going back to 2002 up until her day last year, 2008, is an issue. If there are no further questions, then we urge that the court affirm the case, which is well reasoned and supported by substantial evidence.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Just a couple quick points. claimant walks into the Social Security office and she applies for Title II and Title 16. That's where this process starts. Counsel is correct that by the time this got to the ALJ, she'd already been awarded 16, and the case at the ALJ level was only about 2. But from a practical perspective, this citizen walks in and starts a process and gets awarded Social Security benefits under 16, and then has to continue on to, isn't in any practical way different, depending upon the stage at which the commissioner accepts the fact that disability exists. The word about 16.3p, yes, on its face, it does have an effective date after this proceeding, but it's important to look at what the commissioner was trying to accomplish. We clarify that subjective symptom evaluation is not an examination of the individual's character. Instead, we will more closely follow our regulatory language regarding symptom evaluation. Consistent with our regulations, we'll instruct the adjudicators to consider all the evidence in the individual's record and goes on. The regulations require the analysis that I have argued. The ruling clarifies what the regulations, and those regulations are applicable to this case, was intended to mean. So it's not binding, but it is highly persuasive because it's interpreting the regulations that are bearing upon this case. Unless the court has further questions.
It appears not. The case is argued to be submitted for decision by the court and will be in recess for 10 minutes.